to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Good evening, ladies and gents. I'm happy
Brett
to be
Powell.
Here.
What's up?
And as promised, Ricky Addington.
Heyo.
What's going on, guys?
The glorious return of Ricky. It can be
guys,
only one.
I'm not going to lie to you. I have 5 bottles of Sterling Battlemyre sitting right next to me. It's basing time.
That's the appropriate amount of Battlemyre. If you can't have a bath with it, haven't got enough.
Sterling Battlemyre is, you get like 2 bases per bottle, but it's so good that like you don't mind, but man, I feel like I go through it.
I use that for my demons.
I used to do a bit of mechanical work with my dad. He was a fitter and turner. We had a couple of tractors and stuff. Anybody have that really gritty acid soap with all the gritty sand and stuff in it? And you rub it on your
lava
skin.
Soap? Gojo. Yeah, like Gojo
burns,
and fast orange.
It burns like on my soft, like 5-year-old hands. I was like, good God, Dad, don't make me use the stuff. And he's like, use the stuff. You'll harden your hands up. And that is Sterling Battlemyre. Real
yeah,
men.
Same yeah. texture. Now that makes me want to try to get out some Gojo and see if I can use it as basing material.
I was about to say, if anybody uses it as basing material, that'd be hilarious and probably awful.
Somebody do that on a model. Take a picture.
So
I want to see
it. This is actually the second time we've recorded a show this week because we have had an event we can only describe as the Fackening.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
We recorded a whole episode about how amazing, this is Adam's point too, that how amazing a Webway Gate was going to be of screening your Death Jesters.
Maybe not amazing. Maybe amazing was putting words
it
in my
was
mouth.
Amazing.
It was amazing.
Thing, yeah,
it was a thing you could do if you needed to, if you felt like you needed.
It was next gen. It was the revolution.
And these boys all tried to pull it apart for 20 minutes and I kept countering. It was sick.
I looked great.
$1 million.
You were like Neo at the end of The Matrix. When Agent Smith come at him, and we were just throwing everything, and you weren't even trying. You were just blocking everything we threw at it. It changed the 40K scene forever.
And now, no one will ever hear it.
And then the Fackening, yep.
It's been
and I'm just going to say, there was comedy gold in there. Like, I was on point, and tonight, you all aren't getting that. So just remember, anything that you don't laugh at tonight, just go ahead and laugh and think of what you could have heard before GW ruined it.
We're still going to harsh on Marnius Kalgar on this episode.
Okay. As long as we get a chance to do that.
Well, I feel like it almost feels like an inside joke because, I mean, it's very true, Ricky. You know, that could have been, arguably, it could have been your funniest, best performance ever.
I think
we'll never know. Right?
It was the Rickiest. Ricky. You know how everyone watched Rick and Morty, how there's multiple Ricks and multiple Mortys, but there's only like one real Rick, like the Rickiest Rick. We had the Rickiest Ricky.
And I got to say something, we should keep going in this one just in case, but I guess I'll open it with a rather open-ended question. But Adam, do you have the app yet?
No.
Just asking. All right, we'll continue.
Ricky, you'll never get your thousands upon millions of app dollars.
Oh my God.
Forever a pauper.
Well, believe it or not, this is the best premium hour-long 40K podcast out there. Thank you very much for listening.
Glorious.
You know what? We could have released that episode, and like, you know, the people who take a few days to catch up on the FAQs, they would have loved it. It would have been fine.
Yeah. Please like, share, and subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review for the stuff we're about to talk about. Maybe not the stuff we just talked about. And if you're so inclined, if you're hearing this on YouTube, please join in the comments below. We've actually had some great comments recently, and it's really cool interacting with that segment of the community. You know, we've had a few folks mention, especially in our Xenos episodes, that we haven't talked about, like, gene stealer cults, and they just haven't changed much, you know, and that's the thing. But I will say we've actually been having a very active conversation about gene stealer cults on our Facebook page and Messenger. Folks are really bouncing along some ideas. And so if you are concerned the gene stealer cults are not getting the love that they should, and you have some ideas about what, you know, what they should be doing that maybe you're not seeing out there, let us know. I definitely want to hear about them. So let's jump into this Fackening. So we did. We had a published document that said the way you screen characters is definitely going to change. Smites are going to change. Everything's going to change. And we had a little bit of a walk back on that.
Yeah,
some clarification, right? There was, I think they realized real quick in regards to what came out earlier this week that they just needed to put in some extra clarifications to that.
Well, because there were some obvious issues with it. Like there were some armies that really got hit hard by that change. And the noticeable one, you know, has since we talked about Webwaygates being an option for Harlequins in this kind of niche play. We had to start looking for solutions of how to keep characters alive, where it just didn't feel right. Like you should like the fact that the only transport available to Harlequins couldn't screen characters. It just felt awkward. And although it was a good change for a bunch of different factions, the fact that it negatively impacted a couple, while still possibly allowing some of the jank anyway, it just didn't feel right. So I think they made the right choice. Them invalidating out of show, not so much. A little bit more considerate in the future, please.
Better for the life of 40K, yes. Terrible for the life of FTN for a few hours.
I don't know. You know, like if I had to have the choice, I think I could put up with a few bad games. But like, God, that was our best show ever.
We will strive we'll strive to get there. In the middle of this show, we have a segment to introduce with Stephen Box. So that's gonna come up after we take our first break, and then we'll come back with us. But that's coming up in a few minutes.
So where did it change, Jan? It changed that now you can. So it changed to characters can never strain for other characters. Is that correct? That boils down to that.
Basically, so cannot shoot at an enemy character with 9 or less wounds while it is within 3 inches of a friendly unit that contains one monster, one vehicle, or 3+ other models, excluding character models with 9 or less wounds, unless it is the closest target. So, like, Demon Princes can't screen for other Demon Princes anymore.
And Talon Masters are the same deal. And I suppose that was where people saw the issue was, when you could have these two characters essentially screening for each other, and then you'd have the same problems that they were trying to get rid of with this rule in the first place. It seems like a pretty elegant change for an issue that maybe shouldn't have been there in the first place, but is what it is.
Yeah, it was essentially, I mean, I think they maybe wrote a hammer to deal with something where a scalpel would have been a little bit better.
Would have been just fine. Yeah. Was there any other changes from this fackening?
We kind of talked about the FAQ in our mystery, you know, disappeared episode. So to cover some of the other stuff that came up, so they made it pretty clear, and something they did catch up with, right, is that in the last time they did not change the Space Wolves, but they did clarify in the most recent FAQ that Space Wolves are not all units are OBSEC secured. That's what they had done.
Impulsors aren't.
Correct. It's back to their troop choices, essentially. It was very specific, right?
I do think, you know, when we look at rules as written, and I'll be honest with you, if I haven't mentioned it recently, I am a rules as written guy, because that's the only way that we can really communicate when we go off to far off lands, you know, and play tournaments. Like, we just have what's on the page, or pages, as erratas and FAQs are right now. That doesn't mean I want to play that way. Like, I'm fine to play other ways, or to lean on maybe what should happen. But when we go to organized play events, we only have this kind of Rosetta Stone of a communication between us.
And in that case, I think it was good that, I mean, you know, this is the first FAQ that we've really seen for this edition in regards to the rule book, the GT book, and some of the other material. And so, you know, it's obviously with COVID and everything, there's only a handful of events going on right now. I mean, you're right. Like, what's out there is what's out there. And you really there's only so much you can fall back on. There is a certain degree of understanding and whatnot. And of course, TOs are without dispute allowed to really do what they will, right, as far as event management and things like that. And so they have that ability to make a call one way or the other. The Space Wolves deal was one of those things where, even with the second, you know, not the most recent FAQ, the fackening, as we'll call it, but the FAQ before that, they were still essentially all Space Wolves in the Space Wolves detachment gain the Defenders of Humanity ability, which is, you know, that's their OBSEC rule. But they did change that now so that it is troop units and Space Wolf detachments gain the Defenders of Humanity ability. That's the change.
And that just brings them in line with everybody else. It's not like they essentially lost out on something that someone else has.
Correct.
I mean, literally only Death Skulls and Custodes, Iron Lehman Russes in spearhead formations get OBSEC over others.
Correct. You know? Yep.
So yeah, I don't think it's a particularly big deal. Are we going to be talking about a certain Games Workshop community site article that came out today?
Yes, we'll probably do that after the break. We're going to talk about look, I've already told my friends to prepare to wail and gnash at 2-1 Plague Marines. But let's get to that after the show. One of the things that I think that came out in this most recent FAQ was the fact that desperate breakout rules do not prevent you from using your anti-fallback abilities. So thankfully, the advice that we gave a couple of episodes ago is still valid, is that the things that prevent fallback do not, that do supersede the desperate breakout stratagem.
Yeah, I think a lot of the ways people played the game changed as soon as the desperate breakout stratagem came in. A lot of the way that people had to think about, especially how they're going to think about interacting as an aggressive army or an aggressive footing, really like fundamentally changed. And there was a lot of head scratching about how it would work. Like there's the Harlequin one where they run away and you reach out and grab them again. There's a Black Templar one, Night Lords ones that stop you from falling back, and all these other little things. Like Fiends, Slaneshi Fiends as well, a similar one. And so everyone's just scratching their head, you know, which one supersedes which. I think this is the right call, because if I'm paying CP to like, if my army has this function built in, this you cannot fall back thing, it's because my army needs that kind of thing to function. And if I build my army around
the right call, see I would have thought that this is the way it would have worked anyway. Now look, I can see how people might think, like, so I guess let me say where I think the confusion may come in is that whose turn is it, like who gets priority or whatever. Maybe where the cause for this need to clarify came in, but I think this is how would you play it any other way.
Yeah, and from a mechanical standpoint, I think there's some other games. There are a lot of other game systems that came into a similar problem when using things of an ilk of stratagems. I can think of Magic: The Gathering being the best example of that, with the instant speed spells they cast, and then they have this stack of, they call it, the things that go into the stack, and you get a chance to respond to the spells, or I guess would be the stratagems your opponent cast. You get to have a response to them. But if you open that Pandora's box for 40K and for things of tabletop games of that ilk, I think it could get out of hand really quickly. So I think this is the safer option, the better option. And honestly, it's the nicer option for those armies who have those mechanics. Because if I'm playing Black Templars and I'm coming gunning at you, I'm going to be playing to that, make sure that you can't fall back stratagem is a pivotal part of the mechanics of my army. And it's something I'm going to be using like judiciously. And if you can just be like, nah, bro, it doesn't work. Too bad, so sad. It feels really, really, really crappy.
Well, especially in this stage of the game where people, I think, are used to it, like it's going to take a gear shift to where that's not your absolute, well, I'm just going to do this and so my army's going to function in you know, X, Y way.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's strong. I think that was a really nice clarification on things because it does. It's such a, like the fallback mechanic has been very powerful. It's been almost akin to hit and run, which in previous editions we referred to it as cheat and run.
Yeah, hit and run back in the day it was too good. There was no downsides. You were just like, I roll an initiative test, and usually you only fail on a 6, and then you just, I'm out. See ya, dunk.
I mean, it's not the exact same, but it felt the same. It had the same feels. Attached to it.
It did have some feel bads attached to it, the fallback mechanic. But then at the same time, rapping had the same feel bad mechanic in it as well. Like all I did was get a little bit more savvy with my positioning, and then you don't get even have the option to fall back. Red, what do you think, man? Because you play more aggressive armies than I do. I maybe not Paul being this red thirsty, black raged kind of guy he is, but what do you think about this?
Yeah, so you consider the amount of units that actually have the ability to prevent falling back. I mean, some of those that come to mind, there's the relic that Chaos Space Marines can take for Word Bearers, the axe that I think it's a chain axe. There's a Night Lord stratagem. And then going further with Chaos, there's the Fiends of Slaanesh. And so, like, you're really committed to be able to bring that to one extent or another. It's a stratagem for the Night Lords. It's a relic for Word Bearers, or you're paying for a unit that literally its entire purpose is to prevent falling back. And I just think that it's good that they're at least balancing in regards to the game that, because, you know, so there are some relics that take, for example, the interruption stratagem, right? Like there's the Judicar, there's the Dark Eldar relic that makes units fight last. And they rewarded folks in regards of the stratagem for interruption. It supersedes those relics or those abilities. And so at least in this case, I appreciate that they've held to and held, you know, desperate breakout doesn't overcome that, I guess. So I thought that was a good, worthwhile thing. It kind of rewards the player for going as far as they might to incorporate that ability into their army.
I think that those abilities of those units, I mean, I guess we can look at it as a base level, as they come with a premium for points and commitment to a certain faction or a style of build or whatever. Like with witches, you can't take like grotesque and witches in a just a single detachment list. And so those abilities, I think, come with a premium that is beyond just points. And so I'm glad that you can't just circumvent it with a base stratagem that everyone has access to. Tell you what, let's take a break. Let's come back with that segment with Stephen Box from Vanguard Tactics, and then we'll talk about like some of the stuff with Marines that we've been seeing, and not just Imperium. We're kind of like still on a halfway Imperium embargo, but we got some news on Chaos as well.
The Spiky Boys.
We'll see you in a few minutes.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a community spotlight segment on Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined this afternoon by Stephen Box.
How you doing, Paul?
What's up, man? Vanguard Tactics in the house.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on again.
Oh, of course, man. So we're recording this right on the afternoon of receiving the most recent flow of FAQs. You know, I know you got your finger on the heartbeat of list building and rules and wanted to give you a shout.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited to share kind of what obviously what's just been released and also some of the things that I've been learning from some of the playtesting and events that I've been doing. So, yeah, it's all kind of thick and fast changes.
Well, let's talk about power level.
Yeah.
No, we don't have to. But power rating did get some updates today. And I think, you know, it's one of those to where people have already had kind of asked, like, what are they doing? Well, I mean, like for Crusade and stuff, power rating is right there. I just wanted to kind of lead off with we're acknowledging that power ratings have had.
Strategic as reserves is what's important for competitive players.
I was saying demon summoning also, but I don't think the demons changed in a meaningful way. I could be wrong, but that's just in my first read. That's what I went to immediately was, would this affect my perfect demon summoning list?
Yeah. Then also the power level hasn't actually changed much, has it, over, you know, since the dawn of sort of indexes and codexes. So actually, if they've brought them in line with the points now, it might make certain units really sort of playable for strategic reserves now, which will be great. So that's actually something I've literally just thought about. So I might have to... it's going to be situational, obviously, for each individual person's list. But yeah, something to definitely consider that do check there, because it might be a bit cheaper, it might be a bit more expensive. So you could be paying less or more CPs for strategic reserves, which if you're not using it, you should be, because it is a massive part of the game now.
So huge. It's worth a look, especially for, you brought up a good point with these have not been modified, I don't believe, since they were created, what is it, 3-4 years ago at this point?
Yeah,
that's it. Well, yeah, we'll definitely look at that for strategic reserves, but then let's talk about some of the changes. I guess briefly, the fact that Space Wolves still all OPSEC by all accounts.
Yeah, massive, absolutely huge for them. That is like one of the most incredible and most powerful, I think, underrated abilities there is in the game at the moment.
And if we can dovetail that into what I actually want to get you on for is to talk about building towards the secondary objectives in match play missions.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that, you know, that obviously OPSEC, it comes up somewhat infrequently, but the more your army has access to it with quality things, then the more frequently it's going to come up.
Yeah, it just helps you deny your opponent to either score theirs or, you know, make sure you're constantly scoring yours, because the missions are very much about holding now. In any, you know, upper hand you can get on your opponent in terms of doing that is huge. My Ultramarines list I ran at the weekend, really, there's a warlord trait I can take to make all of my units OPSEC within an aura, and it was massive. Like it won me games, so it was really, really good.
Well, what's working for you? So what are some of the secondaries, you know, that you think are the standout or some of the trickier ones?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on the list and the build, obviously. There are some builds that do absolutely hemorrhage secondaries, so it's really easy for your opponent to pick against you, and you never really want to be going into a game where you're, I think that's the first mistake, is look at your list and go, does my list give up too many secondaries, because if it does, then you're giving your opponent a really easy, you know, 40, 45 points on the secondaries, and you're probably never going to be able to get that many. It's going to be rare that you actually get a full 45. I always think if you're aiming for about 30, 36 points on the secondaries across the three, then you're going to be in a winning position. So you never really want to give away too many. So if you've got a massively based monster or vehicle list, and then you've also got a kind of horde with that as well, then you could be in real trouble. So if you're an orc player and you've got loads and loads of orc boys, and then also you've got loads of the small vehicles, you're going to give up Bring It Down and also Thin Their Ranks, and you're going to give away 30 points really easily. But I doubt your opponent, if they're playing Marines or Custodes, is really going to give up many. So you want to make sure that you're kind of going into the game with an even footing, you know. So if you are going to do a bit of a skew list towards one of those, just go all out vehicles. So yeah, except you're going to give up the 15 points, but then try not to give up any others. So same for, you know, some of the psyche heavy ones, very, very easy to score off things like Grey Knights. So if you've got psyche vehicles as well, like lots of dreadnoughts, whatever it might be, then, well, they're called dread knights, aren't they? Yeah, you're going to be hemorrhaging secondaries. So do really be careful in that sort of list build from a denying perspective. But then I really like looking at one of the most standout secondaries for me is in the category called No Mercy, No Respite. And it's called While We Stand, We Fight. And in No Mercy, No Respite, they're typically killing based secondaries. So you've got Thin Their Ranks and you've also got Grind Them Down. So Grind Them Down is equivalent of Kill More every round. And then Thin Their Ranks was, you know, essentially, if you're playing against a horde, anything that's got lots and lots and lots of models is perfect for doing that. But While We Stand, We Fight is great if you've got really durable characters, if they are the most expensive models in your army. So for my Ultramarine build, when I ran Tigerius, Khalgar, and then a company Ancient, it's rare you're going to kill those three. So that was an easy 15 points for me, and I don't even have to really interact with you. I can just defend really heavily. So that's a really good one to build around. So if, let's say you had, I don't know, if you're playing a guard army and you've got Talon tank commanders that can move out, shoot, and then jump back behind, obscuring ruins, then that's going to be great. And you can just add on enough bits and bobs to make sure, like whether it's side sponsors, hunter killer missiles, just make sure they are the most expensive.
Get them over and that point threshold. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. So I made them to be more expensive than the two vultures I was running. So then I can pop out, shoot, pop in, hide again. So, you know, it's constant like firing fade with their Talon ability that they get the tank order. So that was great. So you can really manipulate your list around that secondary to make sure you go into the game knowing this is an easy pick for me. And then also you're not kind of, you know, having any decision fatigue. A lot of the, I think, time that was wasted from players at my tournament that I ran was they're just there scratching their head, not knowing what secondaries to take. So if at least if you can go in with that pregame, I'm definitely taking this one, then you're already kind of a step at the head of potentially your opponent. And then also you've got, like Engage on All Fronts from Battlefield Supremacy. That's a fantastic one. And if you can just guarantee getting, you know, 2 points every single turn, get a good 10 points for that. And not trying to, I think a lot of people try and overstretch themselves with trying to make sure they're in every single quarter. But often when they do that, they're giving up valuable units. They're, you know, moving away from their auras. They're just putting themselves in line of sight of their enemy. Whereas if they were to play it a little bit more conservatively and just go for the 3 out of the 4, then, you know, you're probably going to get that 10 points at the end. And in 10 points on a secondary score is really, really good. So that's something quite nice. If you're like a Blood Angel player like yourself, Paul, you know, use any of the new bikes.
He
or,
said it. I didn't bring this up. He said it.
Yeah. Are you using some of the new Outriders?
Yeah, I'm quite fond of them, actually. I mean, I think they check off all the boxes for exactly what a Blood Angel wants in their army.
Yeah, and when you get them to turn 3, they're no joke, are they? So, but them being able to dart around for 2 turns just to get your points and then, you know, flank maneuver, 9 of them in one place, is going to be brilliant. You know, 3 units of 3 or something. Or the other one that I've actually been really building around is Linebreaker, because Linebreaker is a really good secondary because you get 4 points every time you achieve it. And an engage on all fronts and Linebreaker is scored at the end of your turn. So a lot of them are a little bit different, but these are great because if you can build in some sort of redundancy in your list. So I took 3 units of 3 Inceptors. They're pretty cheap, pretty durable. And now with the ability,
I think they're also a rock star unit in this, yeah, in their current environment. Just being able to be everywhere, put a fair amount of decent AP, decent strength shots on things.
Yeah, and they can come in with a lieutenant with Phobos armor. That's what I was using. So all of a sudden, I'm putting 3 units of 3, that are toughness 5, 3 wounds each, 3 up save, and a character alongside them in a corner of my enemy's deployment zone, because you can't conga line out as much. Trying to, you know, deny your opponent
well, technically, to dropping in is super hard. You can, but you shouldn't, and that's a big change for folks.
Yeah, and if your opponent is just trying to block you out of getting Linebreaker, then they're probably not pushing forward to the midfield where they'll lose out on the primary. So it's a real, like, the game is becoming more and more sort of tactical and strategic the more I play it, which is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I'm actually really enjoying the missions and some of the secondaries now because it creates these things, but it's only time and repetitions that for me has really allowed me to see where, you know, GW and the rules team are going with this. And yeah, I must admit at the start, I was a bit, you know, kind of, oh, I really like the ITC. I don't know if I'm going to like the new rules and missions, but actually the more I play them, the more I like them. So yeah, for me, Linebreaker, engage on all fronts, 2 really good ones there. But again, you've got to build the redundancy and you can't just have those, you know, rely on 2 units for the entire game to score your Linebreaker. You need probably need about 4 to 6 that, you know, can reliably do it to max out that, that secondary for you.
Well, I like the way you're thinking. So you're not, I mean, you hit it on the head, I think, a few minutes ago with saying that you don't overextend yourself. Like if you can comfortably get these 10 points to 10, 12 points or whatever per your secondary objectives, then you're probably winning the game. And so, I mean, I guess over the course of the game, you'll know when to put the throttle on to see if you have to overextend yourself. But the big point there, I think, was to not overextend yourself so you avoid losing the game, even though you may break out to an early lead, which is something that we've kind of heard talked about a couple of times, you know, from various designer interviews.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with you, Paul. And if you can then use killing to ensure you stick to your game plan, then you're probably going to win that game. Rather than trying to use killing to destroy your opponent, plan out your turns. Think, you know, what am I going to be? Where do I want to be in turn 4? What does the board, what should the board look like? How many units should I have left at turn 4? And then how do I use my ability to kill my enemy's units to make sure that happens so I can get my Linebreaker for 3 turns, or I can get my engage on all fronts for 5 turns, whatever it might be. But some of the other ones, like, for example, assassinate or cut off the head, where you're trying to kill the enemy warlord or kill enemy characters, for me, I personally would never take them because it forces you to play in a way that you might not want to play if you're going first or second. It really forces your hand, and also you can sometimes lose track of the bigger picture, which is play the primary, score the secondaries, if you're just focused on, I need to kill these characters.
You're putting a lot of power into your opponent's hands at that point too. They contribute more to your fate.
Yeah,
because they know exactly what you're going for.
Yeah, they can go, cool, I'll just not use my characters today, that's fine, but I'm going to deny you 15 points and that's an easy win for me.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about for sure. What's been the impact of the 5-turn game for you?
Yeah, I mean, again, I was unsure if I was going to like it, because turn 1, there's not really much happens in turn 1 because it's just a case of a bit of jostling for position, making sure that you're starting to move onto objectives, but you're not scoring in turn 1. So your only real scoring turns are 2, 3, and probably 4. And sometimes a bit of turn 5, but really at turn 5, you can just kind of run away from the objectives because you would have already scored them by the start of turn 5. So it's kind of, if you are in turn five, you are either hiding from your opponent or the game's already come to some sort of level of conclusion, and it's just a case of jostling for a couple of points here and there. But it has made games quicker for me, because obviously the deployment now takes a little bit longer than we were used to, because you are, you know, alternating units down and things like that. But yeah, I don't know. I haven't found it to be too much of an issue anyway. Yeah, I'm actually a fan of it because it makes quicker games.
Quicker games, I guess, and maybe gives you a little bit more opportunity. Because, I mean, I guess you in your tournament that you ran, did you adjust the round time from what you were running in eighth?
So, yeah, I had to be really conscientious because of we had some severe COVID restrictions we had to work around, to the point where I had to get everybody out of the hall and then enter everybody in two by two so they could go in, go to their last table, pick up their army tray and move to their next table. And I slowly filled up the gaming hall in that way. The second challenge was obviously new missions for everybody, new secondary picks. So I tried to do everything I could to make it as, I suppose, enjoyable an experience as possible. So I gave everybody a mission brief before we started to help speed that up. So it didn't, you know that awkward moment where you're both there like, oh, what's the mission? And you're both there. You open up the rule book and you're both there reading it. We gave them a bit of a brief to make it much more concise. But rounds one and two were 3 hours. And then we had rounds three, four, five, and six were 2.5 hours. And in rounds one and two, we had a couple of players that we had to help get to turn five because it was their first time. But after that, no time issues whatsoever. And everybody did manage to get the five turns in 2.5 hours. So yeah, it was good.
That's pretty cool considering, you know, brand new edition, all the environmental restrictions, and then the added complexity of what is an unfamiliar mission packet.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, and we tried to do everything we could to make sure that all the pre-game stuff was already done. So I had referees delegated to certain tables to check the terrain before everybody came into the hall. So as I got people out, referees went round, did all the tables. So when players knew, when they rocked up to the table, they didn't have to swap sides. It was fair and balanced layouts. We had three different types of layouts with six different types of terrain. So there was no moving of the terrain or anything. You just played on what you got and you knew whatever side you were on, you were there and that was fine. So and the feedback for that was actually great, and that's something I'll be using forward. But again, it just saves time. I would have loved to have done what the LBO did, where you change the map depending on the mission. But again, you want to limit the amount of people touching things, and also you want to limit the amount of time. That's like it's a whole phase, isn't it, really?
No, it absolutely is. You know, and briefly on terrain, how are you liking the terrain trait system? The what is essentially a keyword, modifiable, adjustable keywords for terrain?
Yeah, so I found that, for our event, we just used ruins, again, to simplify it. Mm-hmm. I said to everybody at the start, guys, it's the first one of night. Let's just get ruins really nailed down. So a couple of things that we did was, you know, I completely forgot actually myself that you can get the defensible ability to get the +1 to hit in combat, which I only started to use turn, you know, games 3, 4, and 5 when I started to remember it. And that's great if you're rocking around with power fists and things. So there was loads of things like that that actually kind of added to the event. But because we were just using the one type, it didn't really confuse things. Like, we didn't have dents and we didn't have area. But actually, the feedback was it was fantastic. And also, as we do more events, we'll bring in those other aspects as more players become familiar with the rule set. But in terms of the amount of, I think, line of sight blocking we had on our tables were very heavy line of sight blocking. So we used, just for simplicity, we built most of our terrain kits that already blocked line of sight on the bottom level anyway. Like similar we used to use with the ITC, and then it also granted obscuring if you were completely behind the building and you just told your opponent, because all of our terrain had an area like element to it. We said walls block line of sight, the area just counts if you're on it or not for getting a light cover save. So it was super simple, super clean, and there was no kind of ambiguity. I didn't have to get in any discussions whatsoever as a TO about terrain. It was just, here's the rules, and it was clean. And actually, a lot of people found in our event that they could go second and still do well. They weren't getting blown off the table, whatever, turn one, which is exactly what you want, isn't it? You want it to be fair either way.
Yeah, it's so important, and I think this is going to play out more and more. You know, we're seeing things. Just talking about strategic reserves, like we did at the beginning of the segment. You know, I think we're going to see more turns. Are people get more use out of their stuff because of these things, either because of a combination of terrain, reserves, rules and whatever, and things people take. Again, playing for secondaries. I mean, this is still a very much evolving format. You mentioned several armies and taking certain things. Have you had an opportunity to play with several armies? You said Ultramarines Guard. I know you play Blood Angels. You know, have you bounced around a bit? How are you finding things play right now?
I've tried to play with as much as I possibly can. So I've had some repetitions of Grey Knights, like you said, Blood Angels, Harlequins is going to be my next go-to. I think that'll play competitively for a while. I do need to get one more event in with the Blood Angels, though, just to have my four events for the ITC. But I've played with Knights, and Knights were really challenging in the beginning. But now I'm looking at a bit of a different build with Knights, using a lot more War Dogs rather than just the big ones. So the more Knights you can put on the table, the better you're going to do, because you're just going to be able to, like I said earlier, they hemorrhage, obviously, the secondary, which is Bring It Down or Titan Hunter. But they really struggle to get things like Engage on all fronts, because if you've only got four Knights and you lose one turn one, and you want to move two in one direction to stop getting you shot off the board, then all of a sudden you can't get any of the battlefield supremacies. It's unlikely you'll have two at the end of the, you know, for essentially three rounds to get Linebreaker. You'll never get Domination, because not really things have objective secured. They can't do any of the sort of shadow operatives because they're not infantry. So Knights were in a tricky place, but I think certainly building around, again, thinking, okay, what can I do? What can I score? And really choosing those secondaries very, you know, carefully is a good way for those Knight players. So, if I'm a Knight player, I'll be looking at getting Engage on all fronts. I'll be looking to grind them down, which is the kill more. And then maybe the mission one, because actually some of the mission ones are really worthwhile looking at if you can, you know, move and stack onto certain objectives and do certain things. So there's certainly some really good options there. But yeah, I've kind of been trying to test a lot of things out. Obviously, on my academy where I'm coaching people, people are asking me for list advice all the time. So I've got to have, you know, some good, I suppose,
relevant experience. Yeah, I've actually been thinking about Knights. It's like, man, is now finally the time to break out the all gallant list? Can you even do that? How many gallants can you get? I'm not sure.
I've been looking at a Chaos Knight list at the moment because the thermal cannon is really cheap. So if you cheap out on the thermal cannons and Reaper Chain Glaive, is it a Reaper Chain Glaive, Reaper Chain Sword?
The big chain sword, yes.
Yeah. Like, that's the build I'm probably looking at, is three of those and then four War Dogs. That's seven Knights on the table, because you can take War Dogs in units of three. So having seven models to move around, you're easily going to get engaged on fronts. Two to sit back with autocannons. The big three can push forward and be a threat. Two smaller War Dogs. They've got the Melter and obviously the Chain Glaive, which they can sweep attack or whatever it might be. So there's some really good utility there, but not in the obvious way that it was in 8th, where it was just Castellan, you know, Crusaders, all about damage output. Now it's about, I think, a Knight player has to be able to fight in all phases of the game. One of the Warlord traits for Chaos Knights allows you to be OBSEC, which is great. And I'd actually really love Knights, when they get their codex at some point in the future, to get OBSEC as well. Maybe to be OBSEC counting as 10 models. I would love that for all Knights, actually. They really need a bit of help there.
Let's take this Chaos Knight discussion offline a bit. That sounds kind of steamy. I'm liking the way they're maybe coming together, because it's fun to push around the big models. And you know, that's basically what it is. I'm just kind of I started thinking about the idea just to move around a couple of cool big models right now while, you know, things are up in the air. I don't want to get Salamander Eradicated off the table every game.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, wouldn't mind exploring the idea of putting these big stompies on the table.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you can use your War Dogs then to, you know, screen yourselves out a little bit more and keeping your bigger ones a bit more protected. So if they have got Eradicators that are most likely going into Strategic Reserve, you've only got to like kind of try and keep them off and away from you for three turns, and that might be doable. It's going to be tough, but you know, I'm sure you'd be able to pull that off, Paul, no problem. And then also there's things like, which are completely overlooked, packs where you can just ignore, you know, you can only be wounded on a 4+, basically, which in the past we've kind of overlooked. But if you think, okay, you know, a couple of CPs for transhuman every single turn on a unit of infantry, why not pay that pre-game so your knight gets it for the entire game? So it's loads of little things in there that are, you know, quite, you know, good to look at, I think. So just open your books up, open whatever codex you play. I would always say to everyone is open your codex, look at the units and warlord traits and relics that you haven't, you know, given the time of day for before, because now in night they might become a lot more relevant.
That we gave that exact advice on the last show. That
oh, nice.
It's look at this with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
Because things that, plus also now, some codexes have definitely benefited from having the ability to even do that. Like that you didn't take that stuff before, maybe not because you didn't kind of toy with the idea of wanting it, because you just couldn't afford it CP wise.
Yep, that's true.
And
yep.
Now some codexes have, or I think you're going to feel like they've got some despair. So maybe it's time to do that. But anyway, fresh eyes on codexes. That's a great point to wrap us up on. So Mr. Box, where can people find you if they are not already familiar?
Yes, so two main places for me. One of them is my YouTube channel, which is Vanguard Tactics. I'm now starting to do battle reports again, so really excited about that. I've got Ultramarines versus Drakari coming up over the next few days. And I take a really sort of competitive look at battle reports, but we do an analysis of how we're playing, why we're playing in the way that we do. And we just want to encourage everyone to, you know, play in the right spirit of the game whilst having a bit more competitive lens on things. So that's if you want battle reports in that kind of stuff on the YouTube. And then I've also got a podcast as well called the Competitive 40K Podcast, where we talk about anything that's kind of a hot topic or an in-depth look at a certain build. We teach you how to beat certain lists as well. And yeah, loads of bit of a mixture. So they're my two places.
Man, well, thanks a lot for coming on and spending the time with us. And I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much, Paul. Really appreciate it.
Have a good night.
Take care.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Everybody, we are back. Oh, I don't like to be one to complain, but this has been like the cursed founding of episodes. So Ricky's not with us right now because we're actually recording on another day because our recording software and everything else decided to basically take a break in the middle of our recording of the re-recording of the Fackening of this. And so this is the cursed founding of the Fackening. Of, I don't even know. Like, I can't even tell you what we talked about with Steven Box, because that was so long ago at this point. I don't even know if that information is accurate. I just hope you enjoyed the time that we shared with Steven.
It's hilarious that this has happened. So this is my Saturday midday, and we tried to record yesterday, my Friday midday at the same time, and we initially recorded an unusual time of Wednesday, my Wednesday midday. But then on Thursday, G-Dub changed the playing field and invalidated the first one we made. So
the Fackening.
The Fackening occurred. It's so funny. That first episode was amazing, though. Hilarious.
Maybe I can pull some excerpts for a standout segment on its own. But
well, G-Dub needs to know how much Ricky loves that app. You know, they just deserve to know.
They do. They really
do. And how much you apparently need it, Adam.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Ricky. Appreciate that you put me under the bus there, mate. It's lovely of you.
But I want to, like, we promised Ricky would be in this episode. By the way, please leave us some 5-star reviews. We're gonna wheel Ricky out whenever we need some solid 5-star reviews.
Yeah, it's good.
But yeah, so if this seems slightly disjointed, that's the reason. This is actually like our third day of recording for the 1-hour show this week.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, thank you for hanging in there with us. So now we can start fresh, and I finally get to talk about how amazing 2-wound Death Guard are going to be.
Ooh, I'm not looking forward to that.
Well,
but at the same time, I am. You know,
yeah. Let me take just a pause on that. Like, I think we can all agree that 2-wound Death Guard are going to be freaking amazing. But
well, it depends on the points. They told us the points are going up. So if they reflect them being a 2-wounds, I mean, they're just going to be good. They're just going to be good. Like, what's bad about that? Even if they go up by like 30% in the points, they're less like, oh, well, that doesn't matter.
The resiliency of getting a, you know, having an extra wound, having the feel no pain, you know, and having the armor, the 3+ armor save. But let me pump the brakes on that a second. What do you guys think about 2-wound Thousand Sons? Does that make them? Because right now, I think Thousand Sons and Magnus, you know, have some, they've got some oomph, they got some power or whatever. But you're looking at mostly the Terminator build. Like, does a Thousand Sun Rubric Marine with a second wound, does that make it more exciting for you guys?
So there was a pivot at the end of 8th edition to having one big... So this was after the Thousand Sun Psychic Awakening, to having one big brick of Thousand Sun rubrics and then maybe... and then maybe a big brick of Terminators as well to go along with your three or four Sorcerers or Demon Princes or whatever. Two wound Rubik Marines, and we know that they get plus one save when against the one damage weapons. And now they have the second wound on top of that which... So if you have a defense... So let me just put it like this, yeah? If you have a defensive buff and you only have one wound, that defensive buff is only getting one layer of impact when you're shooting into that unit. If you have two wounds... That defensive buff gets to double the impact. Like, let's say I've got a Storm Shield on a Death Watch veteran, which now seems really good that they've got two wounds and a Storm Shield and Storm Bolter. Yeah, that seems incredibly good. That Storm Shield is only filtering damage through to two wounds. So things like Rubik Marines, Plague Marines, things that already have decent defensive stats, they just get double the amount of defense now. It's just literally doubled. Their damage output might not have increased all that much, but the fact that they're just going to stick for longer, depending on the points, of course, it's crazy. I think you hit the nail on the head, man. Rubik Marines, all of a sudden, I think they're exciting. And I already thought they were tipping towards being good. Now I think, depending on the points, they could be incredible.
Yeah, they weren't embarrassing. I think that where they were is like you could see them on the table and you wouldn't just be like looking over at your opponent as like easy meat.
Exactly right. Well, the thing is, like, you could leave them off the board. You can give them minus one to hit, plus one invulnerable save. You can veterans of long war. You can do all sorts of these other crazy awesome buffs when they come down. And they've got legitimate firepower. You know, the minus two rend bolters are all of a sudden, they're going to seem really good when everybody's bringing, you know, double the wounds amount of marine bodies, taking them to their five plus saves and stuff. It's going to be really nice. They could have this really nice niche as being like an anti-marine chaos unit, which I think would be pretty exciting.
Their bolters are pretty good right now, aren't they? I mean,
fantastic.
High AP.
Yeah, high AP with easy access to buffing strats. Like I said, the veterans of Longwell being the best of them. And you just come down, you just hit into some others, you know, hitting on threes, rolling ones, winning on threes at Ren 2. It's phenomenal.
Well, I mean, for me, we've already advised that like bringing in Magnus on turn 2 or 3 is like really good. Like it's better than good. It's actually pretty freaking amazing. But we haven't even we've never really talked about how you exist on the table before Magnus comes in. And the idea that these guys are getting probably double the resiliency without the double the cost seems to kind of make it all like brings it all together in like a concrete thing.
Yeah, I really like it. On the Imperium side of things, I'm scared. Here's my first negative. I'm not a huge fan of the fact that Space Marines got essentially the second last codex of the last edition. I think Sisters is the only one that came after them. Maybe I'm wrong there. Maybe there was another one. But it feels like they got one of the last codexes, and then within 9 to 12 months, they're getting a new codex. Whereas Grey Knights, Chaos Space Marines, Imperial Guard, the things that came at the start, right at the start of 8th edition. Who knows how long they're going to wait? Whereas Space Marine seems to have had three codexes in the span of essentially.
If anything you say gets in the way of me having two wound death company, we're going to have words.
Shut your mouth, Adam. Shut your mouth. I want my two wounds.
Two wound death company. Now, look, we actually don't know. We don't know that this firstborn like blanket is going to be laid over everything. We've only seen. Like, you know, veterans and other stuff. And we've seen some changes to stats on things like the Invictor Warship. I mean, let's say we've seen all this stuff because it's out there, you know, on the internet for the box sets that are the rebranding of the box sets and that kind of stuff. But as far as codexes go, like the Marines are always going to get, we got to be okay with that.
Yeah, we just got to live with it. It just is what it is. But where it gets interesting is does two wound Death Company mean three wound Sanguard? You know, is that a thing?
I hope so. And I hope that two damage power fist, like if that is that's so weird. Now look, I don't want to talk about necessarily speculation, and we don't know how it's going to apply to other things, but we do know that the Marines are getting a big shift, and that the Firstborn Marines and Chaos Marines, like, can we talk about Berserkers? Like, Red, what do two wound Berserkers mean to you?
I mean, it means it means a lot.
You're winning
in regards
every game. You're taking your 4-1 record to 7-0.
I mean, with weapon changes and whatnot, from what we've seen, like, I don't know if that's necessarily the case. And I think that goes back to, you know, Rubrik Marines have a lot going on in durability. The Plague Marines, I think, have a ton going on in durability because really they entire mechanism of disgustingly resilient bounces particularly off of the fact of having more wounds, right? For the Berserkers, it's definitely a staying game, depending on how some of the weapons change. Having two wounds is just, I mean, we've seen it with Intercessors. I think Intercessors were a really good precursor to what someone could look forward to in regards of what, you know, firstborn, two wound firstborn units might look like.
Man,
and so
naked, bare naked, two wound Marines in your backfield with 30-inch bolters. Yeah. I always felt like I was advantaged, like in the first couple of turns of the game, in especially in a progressive objective scoring situations, I always felt like I was advantaged with 10 two wound, 3+ armor save dudes.
Yeah, that's, you're right. Like, and so when you look at it with Berserkers, like, do I want to be able to hang in the fight that much longer? Absolutely, of course. Are we about to see, I mean, a significant increase in weapon damage? Quite possibly. I mean, heavy bolters going to two wounds or to two damage, you know, so it's hard to kind of scale at a glance until we see it all on the field. There's a lot to anticipate, but at the same time, the game itself could really just move in a relative understanding of wounds to damage. Now, the crazy thing is that when I talk about it, we're only talking about the firstborn Marines. For everybody else, right? I mean, like Guardsmen aren't going to go up to two wounds, right? They're going to continue to be one wound models.
I can tell you, as a God player, I'm utterly terrified. Just
yeah.
It just looks bad. It feels quite bad.
Well, let's also say that, I mean, like, las guns have killed more Terminators than las cannons.
Yeah, that's right. That is true.
And so that's the thing, right?
Yeah, Terminators with one additional wound begins to throw that math way off.
Mm-hmm. It does.
So I'm gonna do the thing we say we shouldn't do, which is the cross faction comparisons. All of a sudden, a 3-wound Terminator with a 2+, 5+, and what looks to be an improved Power Fist. You look at a custode guard, which has 3 wounds, a 2+, a 4+, has arguably a better weapon and hits on 2s and such. But they're both 3 wounds, and I'm just going to hazard a guess right now that custode guard is almost double the cost of that Terminator. So that Terminator does need to go up quite a bit for that comparison not to be a little bit stifling.
It is. There is some stifling added, you know, because we just don't know what everyone else's weapons are going to look like. I can tell you from looking at some of the Necron stuff that we've looked at, you know, Lich Guard, a lot of their weapons and damage thing, Rod of Covenant going up to 2 damage and things like that. Like, that's pretty awesome. That kind of balances it to a certain extent, the higher AP and whatnot. There's a lot to that. I think that's probably, it's going to be very interesting with the Necron Codex and the Space Marine Codex dropping at the same time to kind of get a better idea of what the relative field is going to look like. I appreciate, you know, Adam, as we go back to it, that what the app can do in regards of your ability to log in and see the updated, you know, they're, because supposedly they're going to update all the weapons across the board, right?
Yeah.
So you'll be able to see all of the new Imperium weapons across the board.
So I did speak a little bit out of turn there. So Custode's Guard comes in at 49, I think it's 49 points. And right now Terminator comes in at about 36 with a Storm Bolter and a Power Fist. So there's 13 points difference there. There, you do get a lot more for those 13 points from a Custode Guard to from a Terminator to a Custode Guard. You know, you get a better weapon. Arguably, you get a worse range weapon, to be honest, and you get a worse set of special rules, being Shock Assault, Bolter, Discipline, and all those things. But you get OPSEC, of course, for the Custode Guard. You don't get for the Terminator. But on top of that, you get the Whipperskill Blitzkill 2+. So, apologies, that comparison wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be once I put it under the microscope.
That's why we do this. But the weapon upgrades, if those do end up applying to, like, Sisters of Battle or whatever. I mean, yep. that is, I don't know, it's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
It is.
One thing I will I will touch on. If this is a philosophy, or this is pure speculation, but if this is philosophy from GW across the board of increasing the durability of things, I think it's an incredible idea. I've had this a growing sense of not quite dread, but just apprehension at the upscaling of damage output from units across the board towards the end of 8th edition. Every single book that came out, people just seem to get another bucket of dice that they threw at you, either in combat or shooting. And just
that's a great point.
Especially Space Marines being the best example. Pre first Codex Space Marines, yeah, you look at the amount of shots that you hit and you copped per turn, and it went up by like 60% in that next Codex, you know? It just went up so much because of Shock Assault, because of Bolt of Discipline, because of all these special rules added on. And that I can say that
twice
pretty...
with Thunderfire.
Exactly mm-hmm. right. For all these things that got added on, you got this exponential increase in damage output. Now, if GW is coupling that with the start of 9th edition, adding in a marginal increase to durability across the board, this could become a really well-balanced game. Like, this could become a stupendously fun and enjoyable game where instead of being like, okay, how much of my army am I going to lose first turn? Which is literally how I feel like I go into a lot of games now. How do I have to deploy to not lose turn one against X gun line? It's Admech being the one that comes to mind right now. Like, if you play Admech on Bowling Ball, you're like, don't go second. And that was exactly the same for a lot of Space Marine games, and exactly the same for a lot of Tau games, and for a lot of different armies that could build these super strong gun lines. Now, if GW have decided that they need to increase things like the ability for terrain to operate as the third player in every game, being, you know, you have the ability to intuitively and adapt to the terrain on the board and thereby negate the overwhelming firepower of your opponents, fantastic. I think that's a staple of 40k and tabletop games that should not go anywhere. And then now they're coupling that with an increase in durability. I think that's fantastic on their point. I think that shows some very, very long-term thinking and some long-term planning, which, fingers crossed, that's exactly what's happening. There's my monologue for the day, guys. Put a fork in it. She's done.
Personally, I would like to see some things become defensive and then some things that become equally killy. Like, I would like to see the Drukhari and the Harlequins and Gene Stealer Cult become like super killy and not rely on the durability. Like, not like, I would like to see their one wound and toughness characteristic or whatever be balanced by their super precision killiness of whatever their weapons become.
I mean, they did hit that nail on the head with the GSC. The GSC was this, you know, if you got charged by a decent sized GSC unit, you just lost your unit. If they had like four rock saws and two support characters, you could be an Imperial Knight and still get knocked over in quick fashion. Where that fell down was as soon as everyone else had the same amount of fire, same amount of damage, but from range instead of being from melee, they came into all these problems. And then just couple that with being able to push back their deep strikes, double Overwatch or Overwatch really, really well with, like, I mean, how, without turn off Overwatch mechanics, how does GSC even contend with like a one unit of Centurions? They just win the game, you know?
And I'll be honest, we've actually taken a fair amount of flack for not covering more GSC type content. And, you know, I'll be honest, is like that army hasn't changed. Like, it didn't change with Psychic Awakening. And so I think that's why it's kind of fell off the content list. I also think it was also very powerful to begin with. I think it has a lot of mechanics that make it to where you can overpower your opponent with just like a weight of rules. But it's probably worth revisiting in this new edition.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, so you're saying that like all you needed, so you would just, as a player at the end of 8th, maybe the start of 9th, you would just look at your opponent's army and then just decide how many resources you had to put in to kill it. And you always seem to have enough resources to
get
the job done.
I'm going
to
put some blips out that's going to keep you from infiltrating or for getting close to me. And then when I come in, this unit's going to come in within 3 and this unit's going to come in within 9. I'm going to hope I roll okay with this one, but this one doesn't care about what I roll because I'm already close with all my stuff or whatever. Like, I think it just played out. And then the Psychic Awakening didn't give it a buff because it was already kind of good. Now, I'm not saying that was the right call from the manufacturer. I'm just saying that that's what happened, and it's why we haven't discussed it, because the army has not fundamentally changed how it played maybe up until this moment to where we're starting to, and then maybe after this FAQ to where we understand how fallback, anti-fallback, maybe some weapon options are changing. Like, If all flamers go to 12, that's a different conversation than if all flamers are 8 and don't get to interact the turn they come in.
I suppose I've got this fear now that GW's release cycle will slow down, and we'll face this 3 to 6 month period where the Space Marines are just better than everybody again, as we did.
I don't think. Obviously, everything's not going to come out at once, but I don't think the cycle is going to slow down. I think we are going to see Necrons. I really do think the Necrons. I got asked recently, you know, what do you think they're going to be the breakout armies for this edition? And I mean, Necrons, who are double or tripling their number of available units, are obviously going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You struggle to conjure a future where Necrons aren't good. Yeah. From where we're sitting right now, you're like, I can't envision a time when Necrons aren't going to be scary for at least like the next 6 to 12 months. Just like they just have to be. Yeah. With the amount of units they're getting, the amount of love they're getting. Surely. And GW hasn't put out a bad codex. I'll say codex. Psychic Awakenings, maybe yes or no, but they haven't put out a bad codex in a long time. Like one that does not function or does not have meat on the bone or doesn't promote some really good styles of play.
Yeah, I am super skeptical of a combined Marine codex that has Dark Angels, Space Wolves, and Blood Angels and the other
we're going to get supplements. Yeah, we're going to get supplements as akin to the Iron Hand supplement, the White Sky supplement. So we're going to get Dark Angels one, Blood Angels one, West Space Wolves one.
Yes, eventually. Great, yeah. Look, man. Look, I guess I'm going into your vein that you were talking about of like, are we going to enter some deficit or drought of codexes? Like, I don't think that's the goal of what's what's happening. And we might be there. But if we get there, I don't think it's going to be for very long.
What do you think, Reg? How pumped are you for Necrons? Surely you're excited.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I'm excited, especially, I mean, just some of the stuff from the previews, right? I mean, when you show me death marks, you know, death marks are the Necron equivalent of snipers, that they have that special ability. And here's hoping they keep that into the new codex, where when you deep strike in, then they can pop up and they essentially get to shoot when they pop up. Well, they've just given them a little bit of a stat boost. One, they put them at toughness 5, which is cool. I think it was 4th edition, maybe around then, when not death marks, but immortals were toughness 5, which kind of put them on another level above warriors. Assuming maybe immortals are toughness 5-2 off that, but here's a key thing. Death marks are ballistic skill 2, and that's just crazy. Then you take their weapon, which was previously only 24 inches, strength 4, 1 damage. Now it is, I mean, we're talking strength 5, AP minus 2, 1 damage, 36 inches. I mean, that is intense. And so it definitely puts those guys back into it. And if that is an indicator for anybody, I think that the Necrons can be excited for the rest of the range. There's more to, I mean, big thing that we haven't seen is reanimation protocol. So I'm really excited to see what GW has in line for that. But
I think beyond that, players are right in your like position of just waiting to see if that changes. Now, do you think it's optimistic to think it's going to change? Or do you think it's just so ingrained right now that it has to change?
I think it's going to change. I do think it's definitely going to change. I am optimistic that it's going to be better than what we have now. You could make it work before to a certain extent, but I can tell you right now that so if the Indomitus set, and so taking like for example the Scorpec destroyers, what makes reanimation protocols as it exists right now really good is having more models, right? So a unit that's limited to only 3 models is just not like it really cannot capitalize on reanimation protocols as it stands. And so I'm assuming that they've because they're limiting units to 3 models, no more than 3 models, I'm assuming they've got some kind of balancing effect to that. And I'm just excited to see what they add in that's going to come along to that balance, I guess. And all the stuff that we're talking about, just like you said, the increase in the amount of units and everything. I mean, we've still got the Void Dragon to talk about. We've still got the Silent King. We've still got
new monoliths.
I mean, you know, there's stuff that I would argue that is still back there. I mean, we've kind of seen some of the stuff for like the Doomsday Crawler, the new, you know, similar to the Reanimator, the Canoptic Doomsday guy. I mean, we've still got to see some of these things to come out. And so I'm I'm excited. I think that there's a lot to it. I love the, when you think about it, you know, so we were talking about this fallback and desperate breakout kind of deal. And just in that vein, when I'm talking about fallback, the Necrons, I imagine, so we didn't get a psychic awakening, right? You can say we got a psychic awakening with Priya. No, we got a single
one
model.
Character.
We,
you got an awesome character.
He is. I think he's great.
Jada would have just muddied the waters amazingly by giving them a psychic awakening and a codex within, 4 months?
Sure. And so, but given that, is that because psychic awakening was written with 9th edition in mind, I'm banking that because psychic awakening didn't have anything for the Necrons, that this codex better be, I don't want to hype it up too much, but I mean, it's got to make up for the fact that we didn't have anything in Psychic Awakening. And I do think that to an extent, even from the Indominus kit, as I've mentioned before, the ability from the characters and what they've changed with My Will Be Done and the ability to fall back and still shoot, I think there's going to be a lot to it. And I'm really looking forward to playing my robotic zombie relentless kind of horde play to it, and I do think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited for the new destroyers. I mean, I admit, as a guy, you know, playing Necrons, I had three squads of 6 destroyers apiece, and so that was always cool to see them reanimate to certain extents.
Dirty individual.
Yeah, I was, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun, and I think that there's something to it, especially like you're talking about durability in the game. The Necrons have, if there's anything they have, it should be durability. And I think they have a lot going for that. And so you almost can see where it makes sense in regards of Space Marines with the Firstborn getting a little more durability so they can even hang. Again, I go back to my point on relativity. If Necrons have a bunch of stuff that's 2 damage, I don't know how much that's really going to help the Firstborn to certain extents, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, here's my hot take, and interested to see how you guys pick it apart, but I think the entire focus of the game is shifting from turn 1 to turn 2. And I think that we're going to see a lot of all the action and removal of models that we saw in round 1 bleed over into round 2. And so what you were talking about with Necrons, I think they're going to have a lot of the oomph to get that action done in turn 1 to where some armies are not going to have that same impact anymore.
Sure.
Because of strategic reserves and some other stuff and additional wounds and whatever, I think Necrons may be able to be one of those armies that can get a lot of work done in turn 1 to where now the same work that was done in turn 1 is going to shift into turn 2. And I think the action round, the damage round, the spectacular round is now shifting to round 2 all the previous editions have been round 1.
To build off your take there, I think that's huge. I think you're right. And it goes back to what Adam was saying before. The terrain, to a point, is supposed to be set up so that you can't just shoot someone off in the first turn, right?
Mm.
And I think that's kind of a key thing. And, as we see the WTC roll out their standardized terrain approach and you see what the GW is delivering on how terrain is supposed to be set up. I agree with you, Paul. I do think turn 2 is supposed to be the action round where first contact is really made, because you shouldn't, the first player should get the benefit in turn 1, not of being able to shoot first, but being able to move first, right? Of being able to get in position. I think that's critical.
Well, and so GW is so confident that round that turn 1 isn't going to be this overwhelming negative thing that they dropped. What is it? Prepared positions. They were so confident that round 1 isn't going to be punitive anymore that they dropped that stratagem.
Right. Yep,
they added it in because first turn was a joke. First turn was like, okay, you went first, you win. There was like, I as with my connections with Down Under Pairings and BCP and some of these other things, I've seen the stats for first turn win, second turn going first and second and stuff. And across the board, I can tell you it was obnoxious in the last edition.
Sure.
But GW, like, they're really confident it's not now. And I like that. I think that's brave, because they wouldn't have cost them anything doing by keeping it in here. I think it could be too much in some circumstance. Now, you're right. Like, turn 1, you can't do a lot of scoring points-wise. because you don't score your objective until the start of them. You can only set up to score at the start of your next turn. You can pay to keep things on the board, if you guys have already said. I will debunk one thing that Paul said, and that in editions gone by, first turn has always been this crazy punitive thing. And I'm going to say it wasn't. It was towards the end of 7th edition, and it was for so much of 8th edition. But 4th, 5th, and 6th, first turn was always the positioning turn. You didn't get much done. You just took positions and waited for the other bloke to blink, maybe. All the action happened 2 to 4, scramble for objectives 5 and 6 with whatever you got left.
I'm going to stand by my position of the last 10 years. That's a great point, though. It's a very good point.
Like, 6th edition was that to some extent as well, I will admit. 7th edition, I don't feel like 7th edition was at the start. I feel like 6th edition, 7th edition did a lot to change some of the negative aspects of 6th. But
I guess you never played against Tal'Dorei, but that's cool. I mean, I don't know what you guys got going on at all.
That was exactly what I said. I was like, in my head, I'm like, dude, Tal'Dorei existed in 6th. You can't say that. And the Leafblower did exist in 5th.
I mean, look.
But, you know, there's always exceptions to the rule. But, man, like, the start of 8th edition was actually just a bit of a joke. Like, tournaments were coming in thick and fast of competitive events. People were just taking 3 or 4 Storm Ravens and Gilliman and first turn winning games across the board. Just like, oh, I went first to win. Win. You just couldn't. Unless you were in a mirror match and went second, you just didn't lose with that army.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, initiative and momentum, I think, should be cool because... I mean, that is part of the game. Like, it's exciting to get that and to get it in, and to try to get it, even if that's just a die roll, to try to get it and then try to keep it. And that's where I think the excitement is changing is how do I keep it? Like, in round two is like, how do I do it? And then how do I keep it? And now it's not a foregone conclusion in the first turn of the game. It's more decided in the second turn of the game. And that's my impression of things I'm as anxious to see how that plays out as you guys are. But that's just my opinion right now.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
I just think it's exciting because it's a fundamental change to the way we played the game from 8th to 9th. And I just love the missions we have now. I think they're really good. I think they're really well designed.
Yeah, well, you guys, I mean, please, if you're listening, let us know what you think about this. Join in the conversation that we've got in YouTube. Please also leave us 5-star reviews. Like, share, and subscribe. We're going to be continuing to bring out some content. I'm messing around with like the back-end stuff right now, so... You know, I mentioned in the first part of the show, but if not, if you hung in this far, make sure that you get us next week kind of thing. But thanks to everyone that is contributing to the content, leaving those 5-star reviews. And, you know, look, we're going to continue to bring some love to the Xenos and the heretical side of things. I know that our previous shows have been focused on the Imperium stuff, but I think that there's a big focus in the game to make a little bit things more balanced and go with the flow kind of stuff. And like, I think there's a lot of focus on the Marines getting extra wounds right now, but I think that we're going to see an equal balance in the killiness of the other stuff coming out.
Well, someone in the comments, leave us a Xenos faction you'd like. Well, I won't talk to the other two, but I'm happy to do a little deep dive on the state of the game for a little Xenos faction if someone leaves it in the comments. If you want that to be a GSC or NIDS, I'll do a little Adam's special monologue report, and I'll wax lyrical for 5 minutes on how I think a certain faction is doing. And if that's something you guys are interested in, chuck it in the comments. Or if you guys think like Paul should even let me do that, chuck it in the comments.
It will edit down to 3.5 minutes, but yes, it's a great idea.
It's always going to pass the keeper.
Well, Adam, Red, thanks a lot for joining us this week. And Ricky, I think we mentioned the Curse Founding has got us to this. Ricky will be back for next week, but we're actually not even on the same day or almost not in the same week that we started the original recording.
Yeah, I know.
Well, y'all have a great rest of y'all's night and a great weekend.
You too, Paul. Take care. See y'all.
See ya.
Take care, mate. See you, Red Super.
Make my day.